American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
History for jerks. History for jerks.
Samantha, that's a hickey.
Stranger came in and slit his throat is what I think.
Oh, man.
Terrible mess. It was covered in blood.
Those people have boners and their boners.
Those of us that are. The smell of decomposition was obvious upon driving into the property.
So that's probably not a pleasant smell.
He couldn't even get into the bathroom.
What do you do?
He shat on the bed.
Welcome to episode 90 of
American Timelines. I'm Amy.
I can't believe it's not butter.
And this is the podcast that brings you all the crazy, nostalgic, interesting things from the past.
Crazy and nostalgic and interesting?
I think sometimes.
Some people love the things we talk about. Other people want me to shut the hell up.
What was that guy's name?
Brent Nelson, y'all.
Yeah, Brent Nelson. Hey, yeah.
The greatest podcast listener of all time.
He's my favorite. I'm in love.
Brent Nelson is attractive from the knee down.
That's right.
Yep. That guy's a good-looking fella. Brent Nelson, we love you. Shout out to Brent Nelson.
From the nipples to the neck.
I'm a big fan of Brent Nelson.
Okay, today we're going to talk about 1965. We're still there.
We are. We're in the summer, the hot summer of 1965.
We're starting in August, aren't we?
Well, August is done. We're in September.
Oh, okay.
We finished, remember I hurried up and finished August?
Oh, okay.
So we'll jump right back in to 1965 because we got lots of cover.
Do you want to say anything about the music real quick? Or did we already discuss that?
I think I said something last episode just about the fact that, yeah, I explained it last episode, how there's a... You know, you can't really have music in podcasts. It's like a rule. Basically, you can't even put a second of it. So I was wrong for a bunch of episodes. I think I'm going to go back and take all those out. So if you haven't listened to all the episodes and you want to, go ahead and download them now.
Yeah, really?
Save them on a DVD-ROM somewhere on an AOL disk. Because I think I'm going to go back and change. Maybe I won't. I probably will if I ever have time. I don't know how I'd ever have time to go do that.
I know. That'd be a lot.
Yeah. But I also don't ever want to get sued.
That's
which,
true.
Again, we'd have to have more listeners than we do. We love the listeners. Every time I say, I feel bad. Sometimes I say, nobody's listening. But that disparages the people that are listening.
I
so
know.
I don't want them to think they're nobodies. We love the people who listen. We're actually glad it's just a small group. So we kind of stay under the radar.
That's right. Since we're breaking so many copyright laws.
Yeah, right.
Me and my Wikipedia.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there's probably more than one problem of what we're doing.
Yeah.
But we just like doing this and it's fun and we're learning the art of podcasting as we go.
That's right.
And
so anyway.
We'll get better. Anyway, who cares? What am I saying? So I have a couple things that I think. When we go through the music, I have some things that might make it more fun and
okay.
Cool. We'll see if that helps.
All right.
Some ideas that I had. But we're going to start off, and I gave a little teaser of what we're going to start with this week in September. I don't know if you remember, but Friday, September 3rd, 1965, what my little teaser was?
No.
Well, good, because Carlos Estevez...
Mm-hmm.
was born on September 3rd, 1965, in New York City, the youngest son of actor Martin Sheen.
Oh, yeah.
Whose real name is Ramon Gerardo Antonio Estevez.
Okay.
And artist Janet Templeton.
So?
His paternal grandparents were immigrants from Spain and Ireland. His father is a devout Catholic, and his mother is strict.
Who cares about all this?
Anyway, Martin Sheen... Charlie Sheen is Carlos Estevez. It's actually Charlie Sheen's birthday. That's why we're talking about it.
Oh, God, that was a roundabout way to get there.
Charlie Sheen has two older brothers, Emilio and Ramon.
That's
Charlie Sheen is in existence now.
Okay, can we move on?
Before this day, it was a pre-Charlie Sheen world.
That would be preferable, I'm thinking.
Now we're in a post-Charlie Sheen world. He was in Men at Work.
Okay, what's next?
Did you ever see that?
What's next?
Is it Men at Work? Working Men? Remember that movie where the garbage men?
We're moving on.
Anyway, but real quick, Charlie Sheen went to Santa Monica High School, and he showed an early interest in acting, making amateur Super 8 films with his brother Emilio and school friends Rob Lowe and Sean Penn.
Oh,
I didn't
know
that.
Did
you know
that?
Yeah.
That's
but he used his birth name. And a few weeks before graduation, Sheen was expelled from school for poor grades and attendance.
He was a bad boy.
He decided to become an actor and he took the stage name Charlie Sheen because his father had used the name Sheen in honor of the Catholic Archbishop and theologian Fulton J. Sheen.
God, Sheen's name comes from.
Everyone cares.
Nobody does.
I've always wondered where they got Sheen, didn't you?
All right. Let's keep going.
Anyway, Charlie's the English form of Carlos. That's where he got Charlie. All right. So now you know how Charlie Sheen came about.
All right.
That's
everybody.
What the time heads want to know. And then Saturday, September 4th, 1965, we have a new number one song mm-hmm. on the Billboard chart. Since we can't play it,
yes,
I will recite some lyrics and see if you can guess
okay.
what the song is.
Or how it goes or something. All right.
Yep. Okay, ready?
Yes.
I like big butts and
no,
I cannot.
That's okay, not no, how
just
it works.
Kidding. This is 1965. Okay, ready? I'm not going to say the first thing because it gives away the song.
Okay.
So the starting of this. Okay. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I
never needed anybody's help in any way. Yes.
But now.
We got it.
Do you know what comes
help. Back? These days are gone. These days are gone.
I'm not so self-assured.
And now I find.
I've changed my mind and.
Opened up the doors.
Open up the doors. Help
right.
me if you can. I'm feeling down.
What
and
do you got to say about it?
I do appreciate you.
We don't need to recite the whole song.
You're right. It's the Beatles' Help.
Mm-hmm.
This is the title track to the Beatles' fifth album and second film, Help, written mainly by John Lennon at his home in Weybridge. He probably wrote it in the nude. We don't know this.
Maybe.
According to John Lennon, he said, when Help came out, I was actually crying
out. We're all in the nude under our clothes. If you think about it.
This podcast is over. I'm not doing this podcast. You know, I don't even think Brent Nelson like that.
No, he might have.
Hey, Brent Nelson, she's not funny either, Brent.
No, she probably doesn't.
Anyway, John Lennon said when it came out, he was actually crying out for help.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think it's just a fast rock and roll song. I didn't realize it at the time. I just wrote the song because I was commissioned to write it for the movie. But later, I knew I really was crying out for help.
Okay.
He said it was my Fat Elvis period.
Oh, wait, he did?
Yeah.
He must have said that a lot later because Elvis hasn't been fat yet in 1965.
Oh, yeah. I think he said this right before he died. So you see the movie, he's very fat, very insecure, and he's completely lost himself. And I'm singing about when I was so much younger and all the rest, looking back at how easy it was. And then Thursday, September 9th, 1965, Gatorade was created in 1965 by a team of scientists at the University of
Tampa or something. Or no, Tampa Bay.
Florida Gators.
Oh.
Florida Gators.
I knew it was Florida.
University of Florida College of Medicine.
I'm thinking of the Buccaneers.
Including Robert Cade, Dana Shires, Harry James Free, and Alejandro de Quesada.
Okay.
Who always had a bag of salsa with him.
No.
Following a request from Florida Gators football head coach Ray Graves, Gatorade was created to help athletes by acting as a replacement for body fluids lost during physical exertion. The earliest versions of the beverage consisted of a mixture of water, sodium, sugar, potassium, phosphate, and lemon juice. 10 players on the University of Florida football team tested the first version of Gatorade during practices and games. The flavor was urine.
All right.
Anyway, the tests were seemed successful. In fact, the Florida Gators won the Super Bowl 10 years in a row.
Did they really?
No. Nope.
You made that up.
No, because they're a college team that came to the Super Bowl.
You're just, you're just mean. You know?
Sorry. Just kidding.
Want to show that I don't know anything about sports.
But contrary to them saying it's successful, Steve Spurrier was the quarterback, and he said, I don't have an answer for whether Gatorade helped us to be a better second-half team or not. We drank it, but whether it helped us in the second half, who knows? I had sex with my sister.
No. That's not what he said.
Nonetheless, the football team did credit Gatorade as having contributed to their first Orange Bowl win over the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets in 1967.
Okay.
At that point, everybody started drinking it, and the Yellow Jackets coach, Bobby Dodd, asked why his team lost. He said, we didn't have Gatorade. That made difference.
Oh, so it's like a magic elixir of the football gods.
Yeah, now we all know it as everyone always having it. Now right. People do prop bets on what color the Gatorade's going to be. What's your favorite flavor of Gatorade?
I guess I would go with lemon lime because I'm a purist. I think that was the original flavor, wasn't it? I'm pretty sure.
I didn't do that research, so well, I look like a fool.
Yes, you
I
do.
I look like a fool.
I'm pretty sure it was lemon lime was the original.
My first...
when I was little, there was only orange or lemon lime. That was it. That's
that
all
right?
you could get.
Are you sure?
Yes. And then they came out with cherry or whatever the fuck.
Whoa. Wow. Vitriol towards cherry.
Yep.
I first really appreciated Gatorade because I felt like binge drinking in college.
Mm-hmm.
If you drink Gatorade the next day,
it
really helped get over a hangover.
No,
I felt like it did.
No, that doesn't do anything.
It hydrates you. It helps you hydrate, right?
Yeah,
another thing? You got to be hydrated?
Maybe.
Dehydration is a hangover. Other people say greasy foods.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you say there's a reason why that works? Greasy foods are supposed to work? Like,
yeah, I can't remember.
Can you find out real quick and then
No, we're
going to
move on.
No, I'll wait.
No, we're moving on.
We'll just the rest of the podcast for like 3 or 4 episodes will be just me whistling until you find out. Actually, if you're listening to this podcast and you know why greasy foods are supposed to help a hangover, tweet us at History for Jerks. And if you're not on Twitter, check us out on Instagram and tell us. I think you can message us through there, can't you?
That was a good little commercial, honey.
It was.
All right, what's next?
Also, be sure to keep an ear out for our new podcast, My History for Jerks.
Yeah. What's that called?
It's called... you know, there's a podcast called Sleep With Me. Like that, some people talk about boring stuff to get you to sleep. This one is just called Sleeping.
And it's just somebody sleeping?
It's just, the sounds of me sleeping.
Which is loud.
It's coming soon. You can hear me
Lots
roll
of farts.
Over. Farts. A lot of this.
Yep. A lot of that. Yep. All right.
Coming in early 2027. Sunday, September 12th, 1965, NBC takes over telecasts of the American Football League, with most of the games being broadcast in color.
Now, wait a minute. So ABC and CBS weren't in color, or it was just...
This is the first time that American Football League had most of their games in color. It was probably like a special thing.
So
to
it's
have
not.
In color.
It doesn't have to do with the TV set that you're watching it on? Oh, things can be...
Yeah, well, they didn't have... I mean, once color TVs came out, they probably had to broadcast them in a different way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because black and white movies are black and white no matter what. I don't
Sunday
get it.
That same day, the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show for the fourth and final time, performing songs from their new album, Help! This appearance was videotaped on August 14th before the group launched their U.S. tour the following night at Shea Stadium, but it aired on Sunday, September 12th, 1965. And then on Monday, September 13th, 1965, Today Show on NBC goes color.
Huh. So yeah. It must be a different camera they have to use.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah. Probably just had black and white cameras.
Now, don't take any ice in that sip. All right. We're just going to wait here.
It's delicious eggnog. The problem with it being so delicious, I'm going to drink a lot of it, and then I'll be hammered.
That would be a problem.
Tuesday, September 14th, 1965, Jerry Van Dyke starred in a sitcom called My Mother the Car.
I feel like I've heard of that.
It's an American fantasy sitcom that aired for one season on NBC between September 14th, 1965 and April 5th, 1966. 30 episodes were produced by United Artists Television. The premise features a man whose deceased mother is reincarnated as an antique car and who communicates with him through the car radio.
Oh, my God.
Critics and adult viewers generally disliked the show, often savagely. In 2002, TV Guide proclaimed it to be the second worst of all time.
Now, you know what my
question is going to be. Second worst show of all time.
You know what my question is going to be.
Yeah.
What's the worst?
Or would you like to guess what the worst show of all time in 2002? TV Guide named one show worse.
Small wonder.
Than My Mother the Car. No, Small Wonder's a great
bad.
Show.
It was pretty bad.
She's a small wonder. A girl unlike other girls. She's incredible.
Stop. I had the worst TV show. I don't know. I can't guess. Do I know it?
Jerry
Springer.
Springer.
Yeah.
So two Jerrys are the top two worst shows ever.
Two
Jerry Van Dyke.
Oh,
Jerry
right.
Van Dyke,
the
number two.
Name.
And then on Saturday, December 18th, 1965, Get Smart debuted.
I used to love that show.
This program was created by, you won't know this, you know who created Get Smart?
Nope.
This maybe I should watch it. I always thought it was dumb, but I bet it was good. It was created by Mel Brooks and Buck Henry.
Oh, really?
Yep. Had a television premiere on NBC on this date. The show stars Don Adams, who also worked as a director on the series, as Agent Maxwell Smart, or Agent 86. Barbara Feldon as Agent 99. And Edward Platt as?
I can't remember.
Thaddeus the Chief.
Oh.
Henry said that they created the show at the request of Daniel Melnick to capitalize on the two biggest things in the entertainment world today.
James Bond.
And?
What?
It rhymes with Flinspector Spupro. Inspector Clouseau.
I'm really bad at guessing today.
It's an insane combination of James Bond and Mel Brooks' comedy.
That's true.
The show generated a number of popular catchphrases during its run, including, "Wouldn't you believe?" "Good thinking, 99. And missed it by that much. Sorry about that, Chief. The old such and such trick. And loving it. And I asked you not to tell me that." Remember all those sayings?
Some of them.
I only remember that missed it by that much. And then on September 25th, 1965, we have a new number one song on the Billboard charts by a man named Barry McGuire.
Okay.
Do you know him? Are you familiar?
No.
Okay, this one I don't know, and I didn't listen to it since we can't play music, so I'm relying on you.
Okay.
To get it by the lyrics.
Oh, boy.
"The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but that's that gun you're toting." But what's that gun you're toting? Sorry. "And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, and you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. We're on the eve of destruction." Does that sound perfect?
"Won't you tell me over and over and over again?"
It's a protest song written by P.F. Sloan in mid-1964. Several artists have recorded it, but the best-known recording was Barry McGuire.
All right.
The song references social issues of its period, including the assassination of JFK, the Vietnam War, the draft, the threat of nuclear war, the civil rights movement, Ernest Borgnine's anal glands, turmoil in the Middle East, and the American space program.
I don't know. Anti-war songs always get to me.
You think you're a soldier who was reincarnated.
I know. Why is that? Why is it?
You're insane. Well, or maybe you really
maybe
are.
Maybe I really am.
Maybe reincarnation is real, but...
Anti-war, Vietnam anti-war songs like Pete Seeger and...
Why don't you just spend some time like really looking deep inside yourself and find out who you were, what your name was, and then we can research that person. See if they really existed.
Okay.
So close your eyes.
I'll do that.
Close your eyes and smoke a bunch of ganja.
And get the Ouija board out?
No, because you would be that person.
Oh, that's right. So that wouldn't work.
No. Or maybe just look at it. See if it tells you anything. Or just like...
Or spell stuff with it.
Maybe meditate. They have a floating pool. Like a floating...
You're a floating
like it's
pool.
In the dark. You lay in the dark. And you can float and you think about stuff.
I don't know about those things.
Sunday, October 2nd, 1965, we have another number one song on the Billboard chart by the McCoys. You know who the McCoys are?
Nope.
Okay. So I'm not going to say the name. I'm going to like...
Just sit, pick it up somewhere in there.
Blank lives in a very bad part of town. And everybody,
tries
to put my blank down.
Oh, Sloopy.
Well, blank, I don't care what you're doing. Yeah, because you know Sloopy, girl. I'm in love with you.
Yeah.
And so I say now, hang on, Sloopy. Sloopy, hang on. Ba-bump,
bump,
bump. All right. Bump, 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 bump. Well, Sloopy, Leon.
No, this is not a karaoke podcast.
In town. Anyway, hang on, Sloopy. Oh, I didn't write anything about that song.
All right.
There was a whole bunch of things about that song. Because Sloopy is like supposed to mean... something else. Like Sloopy is like a drug reference.
It is? Let's
look it up. According to Rick Derringer, the original version of Sloopy was written by a high school kid in St. Louis and sold to Burt Russell, also known as Brett Burns.
Okay.
Oh, Burt Burns. Sorry, not Brett Burns. The inspiration of the song is said to be Dorothy Sloop, a jazz singer from Steubenville and a student at The Ohio University.
Oh. Is The Ohio University the same as Ohio State University?
No. Ohio University is where that lady went, but the Ohio State University plays that plays that song. It's like, that's their like band song.
Oh, okay.
Could have sworn.
All right.
It was a drug reference. It is the official rock song of the state of Ohio.
Okay. It's not really a rock
song. And the Ohio State University.
I wouldn't call it a rock song.
You wouldn't?
No. It's not one of my favorites.
Man, you're really disparaging it all of a sudden. Ohio State sucks anyway. Heck with the Buckeyes. Right. Suckeyes. Actually, they're very good. I'm tired of them being good. It's like the Packers. You know, they've had enough.
All right.
Enough.
Moving on.
Tuesday, October 5th, 1965, Charles Lindster broke the world record for the most nonstop push-ups.
Really? How many did he
do? Guess how many.
He did 1,000 push-ups.
That is not even close to the record.
Oh, my God.
Not
what?
Even close.
How many did he do?
Six.
6,000?
It's just six.
Six.
6,006.
Whoa.
And he only stopped at 6,006 because his coach didn't want him to harm himself unknowingly.
Really?
And then here's the worst part of it.
Then his arms broke off.
69 days later, he broke his neck and was paralyzed for the rest of his life.
What?
Yeah.
What in the world?
Yeah. So he was a gymnast and he was in the gymnastics class. So according to, this is all according to recordholders.org.
Yes.
The guy went to New Trier. He was in high school when he broke this, by the way.
Oh, okay.
He went to New Trier High School in Winnetka, Illinois, and he loved gym class and became very proficient in push-ups.
I guess so. 6,000.
He knew he could break the school record since his personal best was already 200, and the school record was under that. So he decided to try, but he failed.
I can't do 10.
I can only do 40. Well, I can maybe do 40, but I always stop at 40 because I read somewhere that as long as you can do 40 push-ups, you're at a low risk for heart attack.
Oh, really?
So I just make sure I can do 40.
Then you're done.
I don't try anymore. I should try more, but I just want to be alive. That's all I want. I want to be in shape. I just want to be alive.
I don't want to enjoy my life. I just want to be alive.
Anyway, when he failed his first try, that made him decide he wanted to become a push-up perfectionist. And then one of his gymnastics teammates said he didn't believe he could even do 100. And he said, you can't do 100. And so he proved it.
Can you imagine what the guy's arms must have looked like?
It must have been big in his chest.
Yeah.
But he did prove it. And he felt so pumped about proving it to that classmate.
Yeah.
That the next day he went for it again. He did 222.
Jeez.
And then the next day he did 333.
He's a glutton.
333. And then 2 weeks later he made it up to 444. And then this made him realize, oh my God, I don't have to like slowly increment. I'm doing 100 more at a time.
Yeah.
So there's no barrier. And that would have got him. That's when he knew that he was going to be an unparalleled, prolific, professional push-up perfectionist.
That's what he was called.
That's what he decided. Well, that's what I'm calling him.
Oh, okay.
By the end of his freshman year, his personal best stood at 2,002 push-ups, but Jesus. He knew that 3,000 was the record.
So he had to get above that.
Yep. So on a day in late July, he executed 3,003 push-ups to get the record. But his dream for inclusion in the Guinness Book was dashed after mentioning his achievement to a friend because that friend said, oh, a Marine just performed 5,000 push-ups. And
what?
So then the record was 5,000. That's what he had to beat. So in late August.
Who are all these people that can do 5,000 push-ups?
And who's got the time to sit there like, I can't even count to 6,000 without falling asleep.
Or goofing off.
Or shitting my pants.
Yeah, or something.
Taking several bathroom breaks.
That's right.
Got diarrhea. Irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes, that's true.
But anyway, October 5th, 1965, he went for it. And when he got to 5,900, the test administrator informed him that he would stop the exam when he reached his target, 6,006.
Mm-hmm.
But for the next 50 push-ups, he pleaded with him, no, let me keep going. But as the responsible adult in charge, he wanted to be sure that he wasn't doing something physically damaging to him without knowing it.
Yeah, because,
who knows? If you're like, are you supposed to do that many?
No, I don't think. I don't think the human body is supposed to move that way.
And then 69 days later, in a gymnastics practice, he was permanently paralyzed by breaking his neck.
Oh, my Jesus.
Isn't it terrible?
Yes.
Poor guy. And that brings us to October 6th, 1965. And I understand that the most beautiful person on this podcast has a little something to share.
Well, that's very nice, sweetheart.
And what I have to share is this.
What?
We'll be right back after these messages from History for Jerks' new podcast. Take a listen.
All right.
We'll be right back.
Listen to the new podcast by History for Jerks. History for Jerks presents Famous Gems. It's the podcast where we just list famous gems. Here's a little sample. Jim Varney, Jim McMahon, Jim Brown, Jim Norton, Jim Croce, Jim Caviezel, Jim Neighbors.
Jim J. Bullock?
No, that's Jim, not Jim. Jim Rash. Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Download on Stitcher Premium, Apple, Spotify, anywhere you get a podcast. Coming soon in early 2027. The Jim Podcast, where we just name people named Jim. We don't say anything about them. We just say their names once.
And we're back.
Okay.
Welcome back. Yes. Thanks for listening to that. Welcome back to American Timelines, the greatest and best podcast you've ever heard and better than anything you know. And earlier I said, I made a little joke about the best looking person on the podcast that I was going to be me. And really, it's not. Amy is very beautiful. I'm lucky to have her.
You're sweet.
And now let's let this pretty young thing tell us a little something about gross murders.
Yes. Now, I just want to preface this by saying,
don't get mad.
Don't get mad.
Okay.
Don't
get mad, listeners.
No, the listeners,
we have a warning,
will be fine.
Oh,
it's
they will?
You, I'm saying, don't
oh,
get
no,
mad.
Oh, no, me? Oh, I do have a temper.
Well, I know what you don't like.
I don't like things. I don't like rapes.
Sometimes you have to.
I don't like child rape.
If you want to please the listener who's into true crime, you have to give the details of the crime.
Okay, they like it?
Yeah.
They like those things?
I think so.
Why? So, what's wrong with them?
Buckle
I'm sorry.
The fuck up is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, listeners, I will try not to judge you this episode for liking this.
So this is a rough one.
I'm gonna try to not throw up.
Yes, in your mouth.
I'm gonna
don't
try
throw up in your mouth.
I'm gonna try to not go. Ugh. I'm gonna try to go. Why are we listening to this?
Yeah.
I'm gonna try to stop doing those things.
Okay. All right. So I'm gonna talk about the Moore's murders.
The what?
Moore's murders.
Moore's?
The Moore's, like the English Moore's.
M-O-O-R?
Yes.
Okay, are you sure that's how you say it?
That's how you say it.
All right.
So, the Moore's are big, like, fields in England that are real rocky, and
okay.
Most, a lot of the northern England is covered in Moore's. And so, this took place.
Big fields that are rocky?
Yeah, it's kind of rocky, grassy fields.
Okay.
But large expanses of it.
All right.
So in the 1960s, Ian Brady and his girlfriend, Myra Hindley, sexually abused and murdered children and teens, then buried their bodies along the Saddlewood Moor in what became known as the Moore's Murders.
Disgusting. So it was a guy and a girl that did
this?
Yes. Man and a woman?
Yes.
Grown adults?
They were teenagers. No, they were in their 20s, early 20s.
And they sexually assaulted children
and teenagers.
And teens?
Mm-hmm.
And buried them.
Yes.
And this is enjoyable
people
to listen to. I'm just saying.
You stop.
I'm just saying, okay, I'm just trying to gather all this. And this is something people like to listen to.
Sometimes.
About. Okay. I'm not judging.
The monster you know is safer than the monster you don't know.
The monster you know is safer. So please, gory details on the rapes.
All right.
It just doesn't make sense. So, why am I on this podcast? It doesn't make sense for me to be
Ian
on this.
Brady was born on January 2nd, 1938.
Oh, wait a minute. He was born
mm-hmm.
the same day that Chinese officials in Canton threatened to carry out a scorched earth policy before surrendering the city to the Japanese?
Whatever that means.
He was born the same day as David Bailey, a fashion and portrait photographer in Leytonstone, England. He was born the same day that Henry Victor Delaney, a French general who was 82 years old, died.
Okay.
And the same day that book publisher Simon & Schuster was founded.
Well, there's one we can recognize.
What?
He was born in Glasgow, Scotland.
Oh, nice. Scotland's a cool place.
His mother, Peggy Stewart, was a 28-year-old single mother.
Oh.
Worked as a waitress.
Peggy Stewart working as a
father
waitress.
Father is unknown.
Nobody knows.
Nope.
So are you saying he's a
Bastard.
Yes.
Bastard.
And his mom couldn't afford proper care for him, so she placed him in the care of Mary and John Sloan when he was 4 months old.
No, that's where they went wrong.
She continued to visit her son until he was 12, although she didn't tell him she was his mother.
Really? She just visited him as like a friend?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. That's
so
weird.
So Brady was a troublesome child, and he was prone to throwing angry tantrums. And the Sloans had four other children.
Much like Brent Nelson. He throws angry tantrums about podcasts that he hates.
Stop it. And they tried to make him feel like he was part of the family, but he remained distant, and he couldn't engage with other people.
So there's some people that just... You've described this in the past as being like, you know, people that are like touch deprived, and the love you get as a baby is real important. If you don't,
it helps you develop your conscience, and it helps you develop empathy for others. And if you don't
have it, you can't just get it.
Yeah, you have a screw loose,
No, if only it was that easy. If only there was a screw.
Wouldn't it be nice?
You could just take a Phillips screwdriver and tighten.
Yeah,
that'd be better.
So, he had discipline problems, but he did demonstrate above average intelligence.
Okay.
At age 12, he was accepted to Shawlands Academy in Glasgow, which was a secondary school for above average students.
Good on him.
It offered him an environment where, despite his background, he could blend in with the multicultural and diverse student population.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Right.
So he was really smart, but he was lazy.
Oh.
And so that kind of. And he would continue to detach himself from peers.
And this will let you folks know, if you're lazy, you will end up murdering everyone.
That's right. The only subject that seemed to captivate his interest was World War II.
Oh.
He became enthralled by the human atrocities that took place in Nazi Germany.
Oh. Yeah.
So, by the time he was 15, he had been to juvenile court twice for petty burglary.
Oh.
He was forced to leave the academy, Shawlands Academy. And he started working at a shipyard.
Get out of the academy. You no more petty theft. You now belong in a shipyard.
And so within a year of that, he was arrested again for a series of small crimes, including threatening his girlfriend with a knife.
Mm.
To avoid being sent to a reform school, the courts agreed to place him on probation, but with the condition that he...
No more threatening anyone with knives.
But they told him he had to go and live with his birth mother.
Oh, she'll straighten you out. That lady who abandoned you.
Yep.
That'll fix it.
So at that time, Peggy Stewart, she had a new husband named Patrick Brady, and they lived in Manchester.
Wait, his name was Patrick Brady?
Yes.
And this guy's name is Ian Brady?
Yes, but not yet. He was born Ian Duncan Stewart.
Oh, he was
but
Ian
I'm just
Duncan
getting
Stewart.
Ready to tell you.
Gotcha.
That
you're going
to
tell me how this happens.
He takes his name, yes. So
wait, there's this lady named Patty.
Peggy Stewart is the mom.
That's the mom. Peggy Stewart's the mom.
Yes.
Okay, that's who we're talking about.
Yes.
The mom, Peggy Stewart.
She married Patrick
Meanwhile,
Brady.
Meanwhile, she married Patrick Brady. I got it. Sorry.
So Brady has to move in with them.
Yep.
And
no.
Ian has to move in with them. Yes.
And
within
Ian
a couple
Brady.
Months, he takes his stepfather's name.
Okay. It's like, okay, this is cool. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
Glad to be back with my mama.
And Patrick, the dad, even, he worked as a fruit merchant, and he helped Brady find a job. The Smithfield market nearby.
Oh, he even helped him get a job. Well, this sounds good. It sounds promising. All fixed.
But he remained a loner. And he He had this big interest in sadism. And it intensified.
A loner with a boner. He liked that?
By reading books on torture and sadomasochism, particularly the writings of Nietzsche and the Marquis de Sade.
Okay.
I didn't know Nietzsche... had a lot of, maybe I'm really ignorant, I'm gonna sound stupid maybe right now, but I didn't know Nietzsche had a lot of torture and sadomasochism in it.
Well, we can't.
I've never studied Nietzsche, so I have no idea.
Well, I was gonna explain it, but let's just keep going.
All right, you don't know either.
I'm an idiot. I'm a bigger dummy than you.
So within a year he was arrested again for theft and sentenced to 2 years in a reformatory.
Yeah, you just can't help. Well, you got, as Onyx would say, you got sticky fingers.
Well, and this time he decided he's not even going to think about being a stand-up citizen. He
or
just
stand-up comedy.
Uses this time at that reformatory to study crime and
how
to
just
be a good
full
criminal.
Go, I'm just going to be a criminal.
Yes.
This is all I do. I'm going to get better at it so
That's
I don't
right.
get caught.
So in November of 1957, he was released from the reformatory, and he moved back to his mother's home in Manchester. He had some jobs. He would bounce from job to job. He hated all the jobs he had.
Now, all I know about Manchester is I believe they have a soccer team.
Yeah, you're probably right. They call it football over there. Anyway.
Yeah.
But he decided he wanted a desk job. He was doing a lot of manual labor jobs, and he decided he needed a desk job.
You're a chump if you don't have a desk job. You know, so, none of this manual labor.
That's right.
Crap.
So he taught himself bookkeeping with training manuals he got from the public library.
Oh, okay.
And at age 20, he got an entry-level bookkeeping job at Millward's Merchandising in Gorton.
All right.
So he was reliable employee, unremarkable. He was known for having a bad temper.
Oh, didn't, that's...
But a lot, not otherwise, great. Nobody really talked about him except
that
for one,
that
one thing.
Hothead. That's all I know about that guy.
One of the secretaries, 20-year-old Myra Henley, had a deep crush on him.
Oh.
And tried various ways to get his attention.
I really like that hothead who's got a criminal background.
Yes.
Criminal.
But at first he was disinterested, detached. Yeah. He thought,
I don't got time for a hot chick.
He kind of had a superior attitude as well.
I'm better than everybody.
So after a year of her just flirting with him and flirting with him, he finally asks her out on a date.
She was like heavy flirting.
And so from that point on, they're inseparable.
Okay.
They realize
he likes her and is finally together and they're good to go. And they lived happily ever after.
The end.
The end. Now, that's an old love story.
Let me tell you a little about Myra Henley really quick.
If you, Moira?
Myra.
Myra?
M-Y-R-A.
M-Y-R-A.
Might be Mira. Maybe it's Myra Henley.
Myra.
I was probably saying Myra wrong. Myra Henley was raised in an impoverished home with abusive parents.
Oh, that's not good.
Her father was ex-military alcoholic.
I believe they say military.
Oh, that's right. He believed in an eye for an eye, and at an early age, he taught Myra how to fight.
Oh, he taught her how to fight. Well, you know what they say, an eye for an eye makes the world go blind.
That's true. So, they do. That's very wise, honey.
Yeah.
So to win her father's approval, she desperately wanted his approval.
Yeah, she really needed her dad's approval, who was teaching her to fight.
She would physically confront the male bullies at school.
Boom.
And she would leave them with bruised and swollen eyes a lot of
times. Boom, she's a badass.
Yeah. So as Mira got older, she started to gain a reputation of being shy and reserved, though.
Oh, shy and reserved. So kind of like rowdy Ronda Rousey. She's kind of shy, but she also kicks everyone's ass.
Yes, just like that. And when she was 16, she started taking instructions for her formal reception into the Catholic Church, like her first communion and everything. And friends and neighbors described her as being reliable, good, and trustworthy.
And can kick your ass.
But it took just one date. For Brady and Henley to realize they were soulmates.
Oh, they belong together.
They were in their relationship. Brady was like the teacher role, and Henley was the student role.
Yeah.
And they would read Mein Kampf together and the Marquis de Sade. They spent hours watching X-rated movies and looking at porno magazines.
Well, no, that's not so bad.
Henley quit attending church services when Brady told her there was no God.
Oh.
Brady was Hindley's first lover, and she was often left to tend to her bruises and bite marks that came during their lovemaking sessions.
That's weird.
Yes. He would occasionally drug her, then pose her body in various pornographic positions and take pictures that he would then share with her later. These are soulmates, by the way.
And she's cool with that.
I guess so.
But, you know, that's still not as bad as Bill Cosby because he didn't get their permission. Like, she liked it.
Right.
There are other people that don't want to do that.
So she became...
Allegedly.
She also became fixated on being Aryan. And she dyed her hair blonde. She had dark hair, but she dyed it white blonde. Like, her mugshot is a famous mugshot in the true crime world.
It is. Mira What's Henley. Her name?
Myra Henley.
Myra Henley. Okay.
And she dyed her hair blonde. She changed the style of her clothes based on what Ian wanted.
I can't believe there's a true crime world.
She distanced herself from friends and family and often avoided answering questions about her relationship with Ian.
Oh, boy, yeah. She looks like these guys look like nuts.
Yep. Oh. So his control over her just keeps increasing and increasing. And he also had these outrageous demands.
Okay.
And she would try to satisfy everything he asked her without question.
Like you, for me.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, for Brady, he thinks, oh, wow, I've got this person who is willing to
do whatever I
do
say.
Do whatever sadistic thing where rape and murder was the best thing in the world.
What the heck?
And for Mira, it meant experiencing pleasure from their perverse and brutal world, yet avoiding the guilt for those desires since she was under Brady's control. So she wanted to do this stuff too.
Right.
But she...
To please him.
But she also kind of got off on it too. Because
it's so...
But she...
Taboo.
She could say, well, no.
It's the taboo. Like
Easter's conscience for to be under Brady's control. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess.
So on July 12th.
I'm not saying I will go along with this if you want to do this type of stuff.
No.
I'm not saying I'm going to just play along.
No, I don't want to do any of this type of stuff.
Just let me say this, that if you do want to do this kind of stuff,
yes,
I'm out.
All right.
All right?
So July 12th, 1963.
Oh, the same day that Slayton Doudou, a Bulgarian film director and screenwriter, died. And the same day that...
You're really scraping the bottom of the barrel, aren't you?
And the same day that Lisa Rinna was born.
Yes.
She might be him reincarnated. Everything. Lisa Rinna, you know who that is? Actress.
Yes, she's
from soap
awful.
Operas. And
yes.
She had a TV show.
She's awful.
What? Awful? How do you know? You don't know. She might be a great person.
She's like a plastic person.
Yeah, but she may have given to some charities.
All right. So Pauline Reed, 16 years old, was walking down the street at about 8 o'clock at night when Mira pulled over in a van she was driving and asked her to help her find a glove that she had lost out on the moor.
Okay, that's plausible. If somebody asked me,
and
I wouldn't go along and help them.
Well, and Pauline was friends with Mira's younger sister, so she kind of knew Mira.
She kind of knew her a little bit,
yeah.
So it's even more. Like, so this is somebody I know,
yeah.
And she's lost a glove. We all can't have one glove. We need a glove. Gloves are expensive.
That's right.
It's the 60s.
So she agrees to help.
Gloves don't grow on trees.
That's right, babe.
Let's help her find this glove. And go.
And so, according to Mira,
yeah,
she drove to the Saddleworth Moor, and Ian met the two shortly after that.
Oh, hello. I'm here to help you find a glove.
He took Pauline onto the moor, where
yeah,
he beat, raped, and murdered her by slashing her throat.
Whoa, that's unexpected.
Then together they buried her body.
Gross.
This is according to Ian Brady, though, Mira participated in the sexual assault.
That's not...
Not cool.
Ideal, I guess we'll say.
So then on November 23rd, 1963...
Oh, when Doctor Who, the long-running British sci-fi series, debuts in England?
Yes.
And on the Joey Bishop show, Joey and Vic Damone are on a tour to entertain troops, and one morning Joey wakes up speaking Russian, and after learning that Vic has been to Russia, he believes the two of them are part of an elaborate spy plot. Also, Mrs. Barnes asked the neighborhood kids if they like to look at her bunions.
No, that's not... That part didn't happen.
Yeah, maybe not.
Yes, on that date, John Kilbride, age 12,
yeah,
was at a market in Ashton-under-Lyne, Lancaster.
Oh, my gosh. So this is weird. I know somebody named Ian Kilbride. We're talking about Ian Brady and John Kilbride.
Yes.
And Ian Kilbride is a big listener to our podcast.
No,
he actually isn't. But he's a very short guy that says, I love you like there's no tomorrow. And go.
Okay, so... He accepted a ride home from Brady and Henley.
Okay.
They took him to the moor where Brady raped, then strangled the boy to death.
So I'm guessing in the 60s in this part of Scotland.
No, we're in England
England.
Manchester.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Manchester. That's right. It's probably commonplace to hitch a ride from people.
Yeah.
Right?
Probably.
Maybe.
I would say more
so
than now.
So he did what to this guy? They do what to him?
They take him to the moor and then Brady rapes and strangles him.
At the same time?
Well, I don't know how it went down, babe, in specifics.
I thought these are the specifics that you said true crime people need to hear.
Well, they probably would, but I didn't look them up.
Oh, but here they want them, and you're not giving them
the
goods.
I know.
So was rape and murder
to
satisfy you people.
So, you people.
You people.
So, June 16th, 1964.
Oh, the same day that the collision of two barges with the... Oh. The same day that there's a collision of two barges on the 26-mile-long Lake Pontchartrain Causeway Bridge in Louisiana create a 240-foot-wide hole large enough for a Continental Railway's bus to fall through.
Holy crap.
The bus was traveling north on the world's longest bridge and had traveled 9 miles along the causeway when it encountered the hole at shortly after 1:45 in the morning, and only 8 people were on board that early morning bus on their way to Jackson, Mississippi from New Orleans, Louisiana, and 6 of them drowned.
Holy shit.
The barges were being pushed by the towboat Rebel Jr. The helmsman of the tugboat said later that he had fainted and apparently fell against a steering lever, which drove the tug and barges into the bridge.
Holy shit, that's an accident.
Same day that happened?
Yes. Keith Bennett, age 12, was walking to his grandma's house when Hinley approached him and asked for help in loading boxes into her truck.
Oh, and the thing is, she probably really needed the help and then just changed her mind.
No, she didn't.
No, it was a ruse?
Nope, Ian Brady was waiting. They offered to drive the boy to his grandma's house, but instead they took him to Saddleworth Moor, where Brady led him to a gully, then raped, beat, and strangled him to death, then buried
him.
Then
just this teaches you, don't walk to your grandma's house alone.
That's right. Don't accept help from murderers. December 26, 1964.
Oh, the same day on Gilligan's Island, everybody wants a piece of Gilligan and his newfound riches after he wins a $3 million bet with Mr. Howell. The bet? That he couldn't rip off all 35 of Mr. Howell's skin tags with his teeth.
Gross. That was the bet.
Yeah.
All right. Yes. Leslie Ann Downey, age 10, was celebrating Boxing Day at the fairgrounds.
Which is a normal thing for kids to do.
That's right.
You know, let them celebrate.
When Hinley and Brady approached her and asked her to help them load packages into their car and then into their house. And once they got inside the house.
Yeah, don't go into the house. Never go in the house.
No,
never go to a second location.
They undressed and gagged her.
Gross.
Forced her to pose for pictures. Oh. Then raped and strangled her to death. The following day, they buried her body on the moors.
Sorry.
I was going,
this is perfectly fine.
No,
these are good things to know.
No, they're, you know. So, Mira Hindley's younger sister, Maureen, had a husband named David Smith.
Oh, I didn't know she had a younger sister.
Yes, and they started hanging around at this time with Mira and Ian.
Like socially, going out and stuff?
And because they moved close by them, and so they started hanging out and going around with them at the same time.
Probably wondered why they have all the cuts and bruises. And
well, David Smith was no stranger to crime, and he and Ian Brady would often talk about how they could rob banks together.
Oh no, another jerk.
And Smith also admired Brady's political knowledge, and Brady would take on this role of mentor and would read Smith passages of Mein Kampf, just like he used to do with Mira.
Okay.
Unknown to Smith, though, Brady's real intentions went far beyond that. He was actually priming Smith so he would eventually participate in the crimes that they were doing.
Oh.
So on October 6th, 1965.
Oh, the same day that the Chicago suburb of Bolingbrook, Illinois was incorporated?
Yes.
With roughly 7,000 residents?
That's right.
And the same day that Mario Lemieux was born, the hockey player?
Mm-hmm. Edward Evans, age 17, was lured from Manchester Central to Hinley and Brady's home with the promise of relaxation and wine.
Oh, well.
For some wine.
I'm not really into the wine as much as the relaxation.
Brady had seen Evans before in a gay bar he had cruised looking for victims.
Oh, I saw you at the Blue Oyster.
That's right. So, introducing Hinley as his sister, the three drove to Hinley and Brady's home.
Because they wanted him to believe that he was a lover, a potential lover.
That's right. But that...
Which he probably was, because he was making love to the dudes.
Would be ultimately become children. The scene where Evans would suffer a horrific death. So then in the early morning hours of October 7th, 1965.
Oh, the same day that American mathematician Jesse Douglas died? The same day that on Bewitched, while Samantha is watching the Tate's new baby, Gladys Kravitz makes an ill-informed comment to Maurice, who whisks his new grandson off to London. The comment, I want you inside me.
No, that was not the comment.
It might have been. You don't know.
So, yes, in the early morning hours, David Smith, the brother-in-law.
The brother-in-law. Oh, sorry.
Armed with a kitchen knife.
Oh, no.
Walks to a public phone and calls the police station to report a murder that he had witnessed earlier that evening.
Oh, what? He's got the knife and he's reporting it.
Yes.
Huh?
He told the officer on duty that he was in the home when he saw Brady attack a young man with an axe, repeatedly striking him while the man screamed in agony.
Oh.
So he walked in, and Ian was
just
hatcheting this kid's up. Yeah.
Yeah.
With an axe. So he was shocked and frightened that he would be the next victim. So he helped them clean up the blood.
And acted like he was cool
with it. Yes, and wrapped the victim in a sheet and placed it in an upstairs bedroom and promised to return the next evening to help them dispose of the body.
Oof.
So he calls the police. Instead of doing that, he goes to a phone booth and calls the police.
Yeah, has his knife.
Mm-hmm. And so within hours of his call, the police come over and they search the home.
Yeah.
And they find the body.
Yeah.
So then they interrogate Brady, and he insists that he and Evans got in a fight and that he and Smith murdered Evans and that Henley wasn't involved at all. He was arrested for murder, and Henley was arrested 4 days later as an accessory to murder.
Ooh.
So David Smith told investigators that Brady had stuffed items into a suitcase.
Yeah.
But that he did not know where it was hidden, and he thought, well, maybe it was at the railway station. So the police searched the lockers at Manchester Central.
Yeah.
And they find the suitcase, which contained pornographic pictures of a young girl and a tape recording of her screaming for help. The girl in the pictures and on the tape was identified as Leslie Ann Downey.
Oh.
The name John Kilbride was also found written in a book.
Okay. So they that's had like another a book of all their murders and prove it all.
So there were several hundred pictures in the couple's home, including several taken on Saddleworth Moor. They would pose like in front of the graves of their victims.
Oh, boy.
And they would take the dog out there and
stuff. With all those pictures and stuff, they can find them probably where their graves are and dig up their bodies and all that.
Well, so they are suspecting that the couple is now involved in some of these missing children cases.
They
go a search party and they go out and they search the moors.
Word.
And they find Leslie Ann Downey's body and John Kilbride's body. Brady was charged with murdering Edward Evans, John Kilbride, and Leslie Ann Downey. And Henley was charged with murdering Edward Evans and Leslie Ann Downey and for harboring Brady after she knew he had killed John Kilbride. Both Brady and Henley pleaded not guilty. David Smith was the prosecutor's number one witness, but then they find out that he had entered into a money agreement with a newspaper for the exclusive rights to his story if the couple is found guilty.
Who was?
David Smith.
The one who ran to the police. Yeah. He's the one that's got the rights.
He got paid by the newspaper for the story. And so, but prior to the trial, that newspaper had paid for him to go on a trip to France and gave them a weekly income, him and his wife. They also paid for him to stay in a 5-star hotel during the trial. So
what's wrong with this?
Well, he's getting all this super special treatment for testifying, basically. I mean, that could be considered like this is
bribery.
That's a motive why you would lie, because you're getting all this money and everything.
Oh,
so okay. He finally discloses the which newspaper it was, and it all comes out. And then on the witness stand, Brady admitted to hitting Evans with the axe, but not doing it with the intention of murdering him.
Just want to knock his ass out.
Yep. After listening to the tape recording of Leslie Ann Downey and clearly hearing the voices of Brady and Henley in the background on the tape, Henley admitted that she was brusque and cruel
Brady and Henley,
in her treatment of the child because she was afraid that someone might hear her screams. So, like, you could hear her yelling at her in the background on the tape. As to the other crimes committed on the child, Henley claimed to be in another room or looking out the window.
Yeah, right.
I know. On May 6, 1966, you have that one?
You didn't give me that one.
Okay. The jury took 2 hours of deliberation.
Wait. Yeah, no, you didn't give me that one. Sorry, say it again.
The jury took 2 hours of deliberation before returning a verdict of guilty on all charges for both Brady and Henley. Brady was sentenced to 3 terms of life imprisonment, and Henley received 2 life sentences and a concurrent 7-year sentence.
Good. They deserve it. I have no sympathy for these guys.
Well, of course not. But then after spending almost 20 years in prison, Brady allegedly confessed to the murders of Pauline Reed and Keith Bennett while he was being interviewed by a newspaper journalist.
Oh, yeah?
Based on that information, the police reopened those investigations. But when they went to interview Brady, he was scornful and uncooperative.
Huh.
That's how he was described. In November 1986... Myra received a letter from Winnie Johnson, Keith Bennett's mother, in which she begged Myra to give her any information about what happened to her son. As a result,
be careful what you ask for.
Well,
Henley, I don't know if you want this info.
She agreed to look at photos and maps to identify places she had been with Brady. Later, she was taken back to Saddleworth Moor, but was unable to identify anything that helped the investigation of the missing children.
I didn't remember. She's batshit crazy.
Yeah.
You got to be crazy to do this stuff.
On February 10th, 1987.
Oh, The same day that there was a very special episode of Growing Pains, while the rest of the Seavers spend the evening at home watching TV, Mike and his pals Eddie and Boner get invited to a party where cocaine is offered.
Yes.
That same day?
Yes.
And the same day that this is real, Chinese pianist Yuja Wang was born. Yes.
Yuja Wang. Oh, my God. Yes. On that day, Myra Henley made a taped confession to her involvement in the murders of Pauline Reed, John Kilbride, Keith Bennett, Leslie Ann Downey, and Edward Evans.
And everybody fucking else.
She did not confess to being present during the actual murders of any of them.
She didn't, but she...
But she's confessed to her involvement.
She was something to do with it.
When Brady was told of her confession, he didn't believe it at first. But then once he was given the details that only he and Henley knew, then he knew she had confessed.
So let me ask you this. If a prisoner and a female prisoner each go to separate jails, can they have conjugal visits together?
I don't think so.
Oh. Okay.
So he also agrees to confess then, was he heard that she did, but with a condition that could not be met, which was he wanted to kill himself after confessing. So
let me ask you one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you good with us at calling from now on, anytime we're intimate, calling them conjugal visits?
Sure, that'd
okay,
be fine.
Cool.
Henley again visited the Moor in March of 1987, and although she was able to confirm that the area that was being searched was on target, she could not identify the exact locations of where the children were buried. On July 1st, 1987...
Oh, the same day that reruns of Head of the Class, Night Court, Facts of Life, Perfect Strangers, MacGyver, Highway to Heaven, and Magnum P.I. were all on?
Man, that takes me back. Yes.
I know. You know what? At this point in my life, I would kill to have all those reruns on at night. I would just stay and watch all those reruns.
I would not.
You wouldn't?
No.
Also the same day that English singer-songwriter and guitarist Snakefinger died?
Yes. Pauline Reed's body was found buried in a shallow grave.
On July 1st?
Yes. Close to where Brady had buried Leslie Ann Downey.
Oh.
2 days later, after that, Brady was taken to the Moor, but claimed that the landscape had changed too much, and he was unable to help in the search for Keith Bennett's body.
Wow.
The following month, the search was called off indefinitely. Ian Brady spent the first 19 years of his incarceration at Durham Prison.
Yeah.
In November, he was moved to Ashworth Psychiatric Hospital after being diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic.
Yeah, I guess you would be.
Myra Henley suffered a brain aneurysm in 1999 and died in prison on November 15th, 2002.
Oh, you mean she died the same day that According to Jim was on?
Mm-hmm.
And in that episode, Jim takes his girls to their first baseball game, and Cheryl tells him to be on his best behavior and set a good example. But at the game, Jim gets in a shouting match with another fan, and the argument ends up on the show broadcast. And then during the argument, they end up 69ing.
No.
And on Fear Factor, people have to lie in a pit with a bunch of scorpions. I don't know why you'd want to watch that. People watch Fear Factor.
Yeah, I know. All right, so she had died from complications brought on by heart disease. Reportedly, over 20 Undertakers refused to cremate her remains.
Even The Undertaker?
Probably. So the case of Ian Brady and Myra, I wish I could know
Myra,
how to say it.
Myra,
how to
Myra.
Say that, Hindley, is considered one of the most grisly serial crimes in Great Britain's history.
You know how you can learn how to pronounce it is like watch a documentary about it.
I know, I read everything. I listened to something about it, but
you don't remember
they said Myra.
They did say Myra, mm-hmm. You sure?
Mm-hmm. That's what they said.
Oh, then why did you say Myra at the beginning?
Because it looks like Myra to me.
To each his own,
because I think Myra is a dumb way to pronounce it, so I'm just going to pronounce it Myra.
Well, I think your name should be Amy.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to start doing that to people.
You
I'm
already say, do. You renamed you.
I
renamed
think that's a
my
dumb way to pronounce it.
You
so.
Renamed my family dog when I first met you. Our family dog who was like 12 years old. You renamed her because you didn't like the name we gave her. And I still married you. Well, we already started October, so I'm going to either have to finish it or, yeah, we'll have to go fast. You ready?
All right.
Got a couple more things.
All right. Buckle in. Let's go.
I do these fast, like on those episodes of Night Court when they have to do 100 dockets in one night. We're going to do it real fast. Ready?
Yep.
Saturday, October 9th, 1965, according to witnowis.blogspot.com. I don't know why it's WHITNOIS. Anyway. Hugh Hefner threw a Batman-themed party back in 1965. ABC executive Gail Udoff was in attendance and ended up pitching the idea for the Batman TV show based on that party that was launched in 1966.
Oh, wow.
Hugh Hefner is passionate about comic books. One of his early projects was cartooning. In 1965, at the Chicago Playboy Club, Hef had a Batman-themed party to celebrate the campiness of the comic. He had actors attend the party dressed as Batman and Robin, using the goofy golly gee whiz lines from the comic. Old Batman
doesn't
movie serials
like a,
were screened as well.
Doesn't that sound like a party at a gay bar?
Yeah, kind of.
You
well,
know?
Hugh Hefner was probably gay. That's probably why everybody liked to hang around him.
I don't know about that. He had young wives all the time.
Yeah, so anyway, that's why they did the Batman series, based on his party. And then on Saturday, October 9th, 1965, the Beatles take over the number one spot in the Billboard charts again. And here are the lyrics to that song. Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Yes.
Suddenly, I'm not half the man
I
used to be. Yesterday
is
the song.
Is. Yes.
According to biographies of McCartney and the Beatles, McCartney composed the entire melody in a dream one night in his room at the Wimpole Street home of then-girlfriend Jane Asher and her family. Upon waking, he hurried to a piano and played the tune to avoid forgetting it. McCartney's initial concern was that he had subconsciously plagiarized someone else's work, known as cryptomnesia, as he put it, for about a month. He went around to people in the music business and asked them if they've heard that song before.
Oh, really?
And eventually it became like handing something into the police. I thought if no one claimed it after a few weeks, then I could have it.
That's a good one.
Then he started writing lyrics to it, and they said the Beatles were like, he was writing that fucking song forever. Like,
oh,
he just kept working on that goddamn song. And it was called Scrambled Eggs at first because they...
Oh, really?
The words, the placeholders were like something about, oh, baby, I love your legs, but not as much as scrambled eggs or something.
Oh.
So it was a long time before they got the real lyrics. And in July 2003, British musicologists stumbled upon superficial similarities between that song and the lyric and rhyming schemes of Nat King Cole's Answer Me, My Love.
Oh, right.
Originally a German song, so I think maybe he subconsciously stole that. But I listened to the two, and I can't. It doesn't sound the same to me, but I'm an idiot.
No.
And then Wednesday, October 13th, 1965, Pete Townsend of The Who wrote the lyric, Hope I Die Before I Get Old, for My Generation, after England's Queen Mother had his 1935 Packard hearse towed from the front of his home.
Okay.
He had a hearse that he kept in front of his house.
Oh,
and
really?
She would go on tours of places in England and say, oh, get rid of that. Get rid of that. Get that out of here. And he was like, I hope I die before I get old. She's an old bitch. That's what that song, that's what that title, that lyric comes from. And then Thursday, October 14th, 1965, the World Series featured the National League champion Los Angeles Dodgers against the American League champion Minnesota Twins, and is best remembered for the heroics of Sandy Koufax, who was named the series MVP. Koufax did not pitch in Game 1, as it fell on the Jewish holy day of Yom Kippur, but he pitched in Game 2 and then tossed shutouts in Games 5 and 7, with only 2 days of rest in between to win the championship. The Dodgers prevailed in 7 games. And then Thursday, October 28th, 1965, finished in 1965. No, Thursday, October 28th, 1965, St. Louis's arch was finished.
Was it?
The height and width are the same, 630 feet.
Wow, really?
The arch was designed by Finnish American architect. You know this? You're from St. Louis.
I know. It is IMP or?
Iiro Saarinen.
Oh,
in 1947.
No, I didn't.
Construction began on February 12, 1963. It was completed on October 28, 1965. An overall cost of?
I don't know.
Come on, St. Louis, Missouri.
I don't know. I've never been up in the arch.
$13 million. I have. Equivalent to $80.6 million in 2018. The monument opened to the public on June 10, 1967. Mm-hmm. It is located at the site of St. Louis's founding on the west bank of the Mississippi River.
Yeah, it's a big fucking thing.
You made me go up in it. Oh, maybe I did.
No.
We went to the thing, but we didn't go up.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's huge. You don't realize it.
No, it's huge. I know. You took me to it. You forced me to go to it when we first started dating.
Well, I wanted you to see it.
Because you were from St.
Louis.
We
were in St. Louis.
You can find me in St.
Louis. Did you go
to
Forest Park too tonight? Make
you made me do a bunch of stuff, but all I wanted to do was see Nelly.
And that didn't happen. That was before Nelly.
No, it wasn't.
Was it?
No, because I kept asking you, where does Nelly hang out? Do you think Nelly hangs out right here? Can we go to Nelly's house?
All right.
Nellie was the best.
Okay, what's next?
It's getting hot in here, so take off all your clothes. And with that,
is that it?
We will say, get take off your clothes, Chuck Berry.
Happy trails to you.
Get out of here, Chuck Berry, and yep. Long live Brent Nelson.
It is time to get out of here, Chuck Berry. Thanks for listening, guys.
Brent Nelson knows podcasts.
Samantha, that's a hickey.
American Timelines. I listen to American Timelines while I poop. American
Timelines. We're so tired of hearing about the 60s. I said we're so tired. When you were all alone, no watchtower, a kiss in the sky. Well, I was barely a glimmer in my young daddy's eye. I said that we're so tired of hearing about the 60s. One more time, I said we're so tired of hearing about the 60s. Well, make me shut my mouth.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Samantha.